Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Tonight, across Florida, the rush is on.
It's packed everywhere.
Gas, supplies, patience going quickly as a monster hurricane churns in the Atlantic.
That's NBC News on preparations in Florida as Category 5 Irma threatens. Good morning, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner in for Carrie Miller today. Today, we're tracking ridiculously intense Category 5 Hurricane Irma. Irma, now the second most intense hurricane in Atlantic history. Winds have reached super typhoon levels. In fact, one respected meteorologist calls Irma a buzzsaw. So where will Irma land? That's the $100 billion question right now. And even as Irma threatens places like Miami and the Southeast, thousands in Houston are still reeling and still homeless from Hurricane Harvey. So how do we begin to add up what Harvey cost Texas and the rest of us? We'll weigh the social and economic costs from megastorms like Harvey in just a few minutes. And what about you? How are you processing all this extreme weather that we're seeing lately? If you have questions about Hurricane Irma, call me now. Get in early. The number to call, 651-227-6000 here in the Twin Cities, or toll free at 800-242-2828. You can also email us at talk@mprnews.org. We start with Hurricane Irma. Irma packing 185-mile-an-hour winds. NOAA's National Hurricane Center calling Irma potentially catastrophic. The forecast models continue to show some uncertainty with Irma by the time it gets to the U.S., but intensity forecasts for Irma show a likely devastating Category 4 or 5 storm at landfall. So there's no way to sugarcoat this, folks. The damage potential for Florida and the Southeast is there. If Irma stays on course, it's likely to produce catastrophic damage this weekend. Meteorologist Angela Fritz is the deputy weather editor with the Washington Post Capital Weather Gang. She joins us from the Post newsroom in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Angela.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Hey, and good to talk to you again. So first Harvey, now Irma. This sort of feels like deja vu all over again. Let's start with the now. Many of us as meteorologists are struggling with the best ways to describe Irma to our audience. Let's talk about the size and storm structure. What strikes you about the way Irma is put together meteorologically?
Yeah, I woke up yesterday morning and looked at the satellite, and it kind of reminded me of a hurricane in the East Pacific. Us meteorologists will be familiar with how symmetrical they are and how well-developed they can be, and it just did not look like anything we've seen in the Atlantic in a really long time. And it was also pretty big. We did some comparisons with Andrew, which was, of course, you know, Florida's most historic hurricane that they've seen.
Yes.
And Andrew is very compact and small. And if you compare those two, you know, Irma looks pretty beastly.
Well, and you mentioned the Pacific, and I believe the super typhoon criteria is 150-mile-an-hour winds. So we essentially have a super typhoon in the Atlantic, correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
Intensity forecast.
It's frightening.
Irma has some very warm water to work with, a low wind shear path between here and a possible U.S. landfall. How favorable is that for Irma in your eyes?
I think it is favorable. What the question mark is, and something perhaps that the forecast models don't necessarily get a good handle on is how the land will interact with the storm. This is really unfortunate, but at the same time that Irma is going to ravage the Greater Antilles will have a similar effect on Irma in the sense that it will those very tall mountains will help to break up the storm. And so how much that comes into play is still a question, but we are seeing now that intensity should drop, but it's still not going to drop below that super typhoon threshold that you were talking about for another 3 days or so.
Yeah, and it's a big storm, so even if part of the storm interacts with land, as you put it, you know, the rest of it may be churning over very favorable waters. You know, everybody wants to know, Angela, about the track, and it's always all about the track, but maybe never more so with a storm this intense. So let's talk about the latest National Hurricane Center official track, and then what might be the most likely track deviation in your assessment.
Yeah. So we have new every morning and evening, the forecast models run, and we get a better picture of what might be going on. And that incorporates things like Hurricane Hunter data and also, you know, what's going on over the rest of the continental U.S. The weather patterns there are what will steer this storm. So as of this morning, things appear to be shifting back east. And that just emphasizes how much uncertainty there is back and forth with this storm. You know, Florida is still at risk, obviously. The southeast is at risk. And so the Hurricane Center in their morning forecast, you can see that shift a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Usually what the Hurricane Center does is they take the latest trend and they don't make any drastic changes. They don't want to have the track, you know, flip-flopping all over the place. They want to be consistent based on, you know, their expertise and what they've seen these things do. So you can see it slightly shift east a little bit. But you know, overall, this is still a major threat for Florida, and at least in a sense of rainfall, it has been a threat for the southeast, and it is continuing to be foreboding there too. I mean, the only good news I have this morning is that this morning's model runs take the Keys risk down a bit.
Yeah, and I noticed also that shift in the European model overnight, kind of matching mm-hmm. the GFS and taking the mm-hmm. center of Irma, perhaps, and again, there's uncertainty here, but perhaps just east of the Florida coast. But this is a big storm, right? I mean, even if the center goes offshore, 50 miles, maybe even 100 miles, there's going to be effects on land, correct?
Right, yeah, and all we have to do is look back to Hurricane Matthew. And what that did along the Florida coast. There was incredible coastal erosion in that storm because it didn't actually make landfall. It stayed, like you said, kind of just off the coast, but the impacts are still there.
All right. Angela Fritz is with us from the Capital Weather Gang. We're talking about Hurricane Irma. Angela, I had a question from one of my producers, actually, right before we walked into the studio. Why is it so hard to pinpoint hurricanes? I always tell people hurricanes and snowstorms. Those are the two biggest challenges we face as meteorologists. So what is it with hurricanes, and what do we tell the public about the uncertainty?
You know, sometimes I wonder if the uncertainty isn't it's probably not any higher than any other weather phenomenon. It's just that they are such high impact that even the slightest deviation, you know, even the slightest mistake, so to speak, in the forecast is incredibly consequential. And so I think that has a lot to do with it. This is a very high impact storm, and we want to know exactly where it's going. Even though on a grand global scale, the shifts and the differences in the track forecast that we're seeing are minuscule. And so that, I think, has a lot to do with it. It might be a perception issue. The other problem is, you know, global weather is a chaotic system. And where this storm goes depends on, you know, weather systems that are out over the northern Pacific right now.
Mm-hmm.
And to you know, you're predicting the future of a chaotic system, you know, a week in advance. It's remarkable that we even know where it's going to go over the next few days, let alone the fact that we are fairly certain this is a high impact risk for Florida and the southeast. And so I think that's why we keep telling people to prepare and do what you would do if you were certain that something was going to make landfall, but know that, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty here, and it's just best to be prepared. So, yeah.
Yep.
I would say, you know, uncertainty and perception right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think as devastating as Harvey was, we can sort of call that a forecast success story because we gave people a lot of lead time. We're doing the same thing with Irma.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly where it's going to land yet, but we're getting closer to that. Let's take a call. Ray Lynn from Plymouth, good morning. Do you have a question for Angela Fritz about Hurricane Irma?
Actually, I wanted to talk about how the impact on the U.S. is being discussed.
Mm-hmm.
It's hitting the U.S. today.
Correct.
It's hitting the United States, Virgin Islands, and then Puerto Rico either today or tomorrow. And to talk about it not hitting the U.S. for a couple of days is really hurtful to those of us that can't reach our families in the Caribbean right now that are starting to lose contact. And we're still part of the U.S. and we're, you know, we're citizens of this country. And we often get glossed over because we're so small, but we are important. And we're desperately listening for what news we can get for our own families as we watch this hurricane come through. We haven't had one this significant since Hugo in 89. We've had some other big ones since then, but it's hitting the U.S. today, not in a couple days.
Great point, Ray Lynn. And Angela, you know, we did see some direct eye landfalls overnight, Barbuda, some of the islands.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about what we know from where Irma struck overnight and early this morning.
Yeah, and it's hard to tell because during these storms, communication drops, and we don't know until things start to get better, which won't be for a couple of days. But, you know, to the caller's point, yes, Puerto Rico is a very high risk in this. And like she said, they haven't seen a storm like this in a very long time. And in particular, the path that it's taking and the way it's approaching so close to San Juan, which, you know, normally storms come up through the Gulf of Mexico. And if they're going to impact the island, it's going to be kind of on the southern side. This is a little bit different. And so it might be that the people of Puerto Rico are not prepared because they've never really experienced something like this before. And I've been in touch with a few people that have family down there. And the rain started this morning, actually. We're getting some reports in from there. And it's something we'll be watching closely over the next 36 hours.
You know, I know we're in the islands today with this storm. We are looking ahead also to the U.S. mainland this weekend. Angela, I wrote yesterday, Florida is a bit like a hurricane evacuation puzzle. The orientation of the storm, the track parallel to the Florida Peninsula, it's a major operational challenge for evacuation. Even a shift of 50 miles can bring different effects for major cities. How do emergency managers tell people to evacuate with enough time in a situation like this?
Well, fortunately, we knew as early as even Saturday or Sunday that this is something that they should be preparing for. So I hope, and I don't want their job, they have Florida emergency managers have some of the hardest jobs in the country. And I hope that they have a plan. Evacuating the Keys, I think, was a very smart idea. You know, the problem with that is, again, where do you go? It's 7 hours to Orlando, and Orlando might be at risk as well. And so it is a challenge, unlike any other, this particular storm, simply because you have to keep driving and people don't realize how tall Florida is and how long it takes to get from, say, Miami to a place like Tallahassee. And there's not that many roads also.
Right.
You know?
And they all go in the same direction.
They're just a couple of highways. Yeah, exactly.
So Florida, right? But South Carolina, potentially, Georgia, not looking good with this. And, of course, you guys sitting up in Washington, D.C., you know, what else are we looking at here? I mean, this is obviously going to unfold over the next several days. And this is different than Harvey. This may not be the massive flood situation, but we're talking wind and storm surge. Let's talk about 150-mile-an-hour winds. I mean, what does this look like after landfall?
Yeah, I mean, and it, of course, will depend on where it makes landfall, because that is critical, too. But I am hoping that we see the storm weaken before it reaches the southeast coast, simply because the wind speeds are so intense, and we haven't seen a hurricane that intense on this side of the country in a very long time. If Harvey, which was a Category 4 at landfall, you know, had made landfall in Florida, that would have been devastating, just as it was devastating for the people around Corpus Christi and Rockport. And so that is something that, gosh, I wish I could tell you exactly where it's going to hit and how strong it's going to be. But I think we just need to be prepared for the worst. We need to be prepared for intense storm surge, inland flooding, and down trees, which will lead to power outages for potentially days for some people.
Yeah, and I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about this. The climate change context with hurricane intensity and extreme rainfall events that we're seeing. How is Capital Weather Gang, I know Jason Zamenow there with you, how are you guys writing about that these days?
You know, someone asked me yesterday on WDEL the same question, and they said, you know, what do you say to people who have been pointing to the lack in hurricanes as a reason to deny that climate change exists? And I just say, you know, I'm having a hard time not ignoring that. Mm-hmm. Because look at Harvey. Harvey was an exceptional storm, and now we have another one right on its heels. So this idea that, you know, we got lucky, you know, in the past 12 years, we've been extremely lucky. And that's all I can really crack that up to. And that's all the research can crack it up to, too, is that, good, I'm glad that we didn't have a major hurricane landfall. That makes me very happy. But the way things are going, we know how hurricanes form. We know how they strengthen. Ocean temperatures are rising. That will lead to stronger storms. And the connection, you know, the theoretical connection is very strong there. And we are seeing the impacts. And something I like to say, and something I've written on the Capital Weather Gang, is that the fingerprint of climate change is on every weather event now. It's just a matter of how much. So they're all, it's all just kind of inherently linked at this point.
Meteorologist Angela Fritz, deputy weather editor with the Washington Post Capital Weather Gang. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you, and good luck to you and everyone else on the coast with Irma.
Thanks, Paul.
From Miami, we are sending love to Houston. We are praying that you make it through the rain.
That's Coldplay at their show in Miami, sending love to Houston in that special song they wrote after Harvey. The irony, nothing short of amazing now, just 2 weeks later, Irma threatens Miami, Florida, the Southeast U.S. I feel like Harvey put an emotional toll on all of us, but how do we begin to quantify Harvey's economic costs? We'll break that down next, but first, here's Phil Picardi with the news.
Hi, Paul. Antigua and Barbuda Prime Minister Gaston Brown says the Twin Island nation appears to have weathered its brush with Hurricane Irma. Brown says in a statement, there were no deaths in Antigua. Lawyers for a Florida man scheduled to be executed want a delay in last-minute court proceedings due to the threat of Hurricane Irma. Martin McLean says in a motion filed today that he and other lawyers representing Michael Ray Lambrix, they live in the expected path of the Category 5 storm. He says the attorneys need time to help their families get ready for the storm. Immigrants and activists have launched efforts to fight a decision by the Trump administration to dismantle the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. DACA, enacted by President Obama, protected hundreds of thousands of young people who were brought into the country illegally from deportation. Opponents of the program say it is an unconstitutional abuse of executive power. Officials say Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's wife is heading to Bangladesh to oversee the distribution of aid to Muslim Rohingya refugees from Myanmar and to highlight the crisis there. Officials from Erdogan's office say the president's wife will be accompanied by her son and senior aid officials during her visit to refugee camps in Bangladesh. About 125,000 ethnic minority Rohingyas have fled a military crackdown in Myanmar. China has once again urged the U.S. and South Korea to halt the deployment of a high-tech missile defense system in South Korea. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Zheng Zhuang says China remains strongly opposed to it. The U.S. military is to add more launchers on Thursday to a terminal high-altitude area defense battery that it began setting up in rural South Korea earlier this year. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:25.
Later on All Things Considered, people who grew up in the U.S. respond to the threat of deportation with the White House repeal of DACA and tracking the record-setting Hurricane Irma. Those stories, appetites, and all the day's news, starting at 3.
Support comes from NS2, presenting singer-songwriter John Prine at the Northrop Auditorium this Friday night and at The Deck in Duluth this Saturday night. Tickets available at northrop.umn.edu and at ticketmaster.com.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up on NPR News, schools across Minnesota are getting more racially diverse, but the school boards that run those districts are not. My colleague Solveig Wasfedt had a story about this. It's online right now, and we're going to discuss it at 11.
Support comes from NS2, presenting singer-songwriter John Prine at the Northrop Auditorium this Friday night and at The Deck in Duluth this Saturday night. Tickets available at northrop.umn.edu and at ticketmaster.com.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. Wow, what is this anyway? Extreme weather month on NPR News. We're watching Irma, still a 185-mile-an-hour hurricane, dealing a devastating blow to the Windward and Leeward Islands, heading for Puerto Rico. But we're also trying to find some perspective on Hurricane Harvey. It was just 2 weeks ago we watched Harvey blow up and head for Texas. And it's still early, probably too early to calculate Harvey's social and economic costs fully. But some mind-blowing numbers are already coming out of Texas from Harvey. At least 60 deaths are now confirmed from Harvey. 50,000 plus still evacuated in shelters or government-paid hotel rooms. 200,000 homes damaged or destroyed. That's from the Texas Department of Public Safety. Up to 1 million cars underwater from Harvey. Insurance losses may be anywhere from $2 to $5 billion on just cars alone. Gas prices, have you been to the pump lately? Up 30 cents a gallon nationally, 50 cents in Texas. Moody's Analytics estimates total costs from Harvey could be over $100 billion. Texas Governor Greg Abbott says it's more like $180 billion. So how do we begin to quantify the costs of major extreme weather disasters? And how do we assess the social and other costs of these extreme weather events? And who should ultimately pay and will ultimately pay for the increasing cost of climate-enhanced weather disasters? Call me now if you have questions about the cost of these big disasters. The number to call is 651-227-6000 in the Twin Cities, toll-free 800-242-2828. Noah Diffenbaugh is an earth sciences professor at and Kimmelman Family Senior Fellow at Stanford University. Welcome, Noah.
Thank you.
And Nusha Ajami is a senior research associate with Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. She's a hydrologist specializing in sustainable water resource management, flood and water supply forecasting. Nusha, good morning.
Good morning.
Noah, last week on our ClimateCast show here on NPR News, I focused on some of the physical relationships between warmer oceans and hurricanes like Harvey and Irma. We know warmer oceans are extra fuel for these hurricanes, but how do we begin to quantify that effect?
Well, so the area of science and that deals with trying to understand the effect of global warming on extremes, and in particular individual extreme events like Harvey, like the California drought, like the flooding that we're seeing in South Asia now, that area of science is called extreme event attribution. And what scientists do in that area of science is to frame independent, objective, testable hypotheses and then go about trying to test them. So a less jargony way of saying that is that we start from the position that global warming had no effect, and then we develop different lines of evidence. We pursue different lines of analysis, and we only implicate global warming if those lines of evidence rise to a very high level of proof.
And that's well said. We're all about the less jargony speech here. That's great. Thank you, Noah. Nusha, I know you work as a water and hydrologist and engineer. You work with water all the time. How do we model for and sort of adapt to these climate-enhanced extreme rainfall totals like the 50 inches we saw in Houston?
You know, the urban setting that we have currently is very, does not really absorb water as much as it should. And the modeling that we do is generally very top-down. So we hope we sort of assume how much rain is going to come. We try to understand how the ground or the urban setting or actually the natural systems that we have would respond to such a rain. Unfortunately, again, when you create these bathtubs, they don't really have as much capacity, and a lot of the hydrology depends on the infiltration rates. Mm-hmm. So we assume whatever rain comes down, some of it is going to infiltrate as it falls on the land, and then some of it will go as a runoff and flow over the ground wherever it is. And unfortunately, in our cities, they just actually, a majority of that rain end up like flowing over the ground rather than infiltrating. And then you can see what happens with Hurricane Harvey. For a storm that intense, obviously there's not enough absorption on land to absorb all that water, but it could dampen the impacts, and that is what we want to make sure we increase the capacity of the ground in as much that it would we would use these natural systems to dampen some of these impacts.
You know, one specific thing I thought of, Nusha, was this water plant in Beaumont, Texas, 120,000 in that town without water. What's the potential when these things get flooded for long-term damage in systems like this?
And the problem is, you know, there's so much pollution around us. And as the rain and storms comes and surge and sort of carries over all this pollution, and some of them actually end up from a place that we hope that we are containing them to places that they should never be. And the long-term impacts are sometimes it's very hard to measure because, you know, it can impact the health of the community for a long time. It can impact groundwater resources for a long time coming. Some of these communities do depend on groundwater. So if the groundwater is contaminated, it will be very hard to clean up very quickly and bring them to the way that we can use them. And then another thing is sometimes you really take away the resiliency of these communities, because if you are taking away the sort of groundwater source or water source that they depend on and bring down the quality of it, degrade the quality, then that community basically have nothing else to depend on. And we need to make a lot of actual investment to bring water from other sources. And these are some of the externalities that we don't think about when we are actually accounting for the impacts of some of these storms and extreme events, all of them, droughts, storms, floods, hurricanes, all of them.
Noah, I hear us, and we're sort of talking about infrastructure here, and I make this point often on our ClimateCast show that our cities and infrastructure are built on 20th century climate assumptions that really may no longer fit our 21st century climate. How do we get at the cost of adapting our infrastructure versus doing little or nothing and paying the high price as each extreme weather event hits?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that if we don't acknowledge that the climate has changed, then we will continue to pay for the price of these extreme events as they happen. And we know, for example, that with the National Flood Insurance Program, the Government Accounting Office has already done an assessment and determined that the real risk is not reflected in the way that the current program is designed and administered. And that has to do both with the kinds of issues that Nusha was talking about with land use and development, and it also has to do with the fact that you were mentioning that the probability of extreme events is changing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if we have opportunities to acknowledge in an explicit way, quantitative way, the ways in which those risks are changing, and incorporate those changes into infrastructure planning. And in fact, the Obama administration did add that requirement into the federal infrastructure process. As we know, last month, President Trump announced that he was rolling back those requirements.
And I want to touch real quickly again on that National Flood Insurance Program. I hear a couple of questions here ruminating throughout the populace from time to time. Are we essentially subsidizing development in flood zones? And what about the moral hazard? If somebody takes a risk to live in a flood-prone area, why should somebody else pay for that? Noah, do you want to take a crack at that?
Well, there are a lot of anecdotal stories out there of individual cases of structures that have been flooded multiple times and rebuilding in floodplains. I think the main consideration is that we do have development in places where the market if it incorporated the real risk, that the prices would be much higher. Given the real risk, and certainly in areas where we have landfalling tropical cyclones as a real regular part of life, areas where there's threat of coastal inundation from landfalling storms, floodplains, where there are established floodplains, these are all areas where the market left to its own devices would charge premiums that are higher than what really homeowners would be able or willing to pay.
Even write policies, right? Because many insurance companies won't write policies in those areas.
Exactly. So the National Flood Insurance Program really is the mechanism by which American homeowners buy flood insurance, and we know that that the risks are changing, and that not only is the program in debt now, but it also is not structured to take into account the changing risk profile.
Yeah. If you've just dropped in with us, we're talking with Noah Diffenbaugh and Nusha Ajami, both from Stanford University, about the economic and social costs of our changing climate and climate-enhanced events. It's apparently the Stanford Radio Hour here, so that's a good thing today, you guys. If you want to jump in and give us a call, 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 800-242-2828. Who's going to pay for these climate-enhanced disasters, or what is your take as we see these extreme weather events going forward? Jump in and give us a call. Nusha, I'm curious, as you look around state to state, how dramatic are the differences in how individual states plan and adapt for climate change and for these extreme weather events we're seeing?
I mean, it really depends on the state-level policy and sometimes local policy. One thing I wanted to mention is, there needs to be some integration between land use and flood management and water resource management, and that is actually a missing link in many of these states. And you mentioned about 20th century infrastructure for the 21st century climate. Mm-hmm. I think another thing is that we need to have a 21st century infrastructure solution. And some of that includes, instead of creating this rigid engineering solutions, we have to consider how can we work with nature and natural systems to increase the flexibility of our environment in order to be able to handle some of these realities that we are facing in the 21st century. And that goes back to the way we set these laws and policies and creating sort of more coordination between different agencies to make sure that we do think about flooding when we are actually planning our next, subdivision in a neighborhood that it should not, exist. Or if you want to put a subdivision somewhere that's flood prone, maybe that subdivision should not be have so much impervious spaces. Or actually, another thing is making sure that people understand what are the risks. What does it mean to them and to their future if they make these purchases and live in these areas? So I think it is a multi-level effort that needs to happen. And again, going back, state to state is very different. In California, we do talk about climate change and how sea level rise can impact our infrastructure, especially wastewater treatment plants or airports, all the other infrastructure that are generally at the edge of the water, at the bay or the ocean. But not every state incorporate these kind of, assumptions in their planning. So hopefully, I really hope that Harvey was not just something that it happened and then in a few months we forget about it. But I really hope that cities like Houston and other cities that are dealing with some of these issues actually take this into heart and try to become more resilient and be able to build these systems for what you're facing in this century and incorporate some of the solutions that make their cities more flexible.
Great point. Noosha Ajami from Stanford University. I want to thank you now and say goodbye and thank you for your great perspective today. We're going to grab the next guest on the line. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Noah,
have a great night.
Yeah, you too. Noah, one more question for you. We add up the economic costs of these extreme storms, these hurricanes. What are some of the social and other costs, and how do we begin to quantify those?
Well, we know from years of research that poverty and inequality create acute vulnerability to extreme events. And we certainly saw that here during the California drought in terms of, who was hit hardest, in some cases going months and months and months without running water. We've seen that in many flood events and tropical cyclones. We're seeing it now around the world if we look at what's happening in South Asia with the more than 1,000 people, something on the order of 1,500 people killed in those events.
Yeah.
So at the most fundamental level of survival, certainly, mm-hmm. we're gonna get a dollar cost out of at the end of the assessment for Hurricane Harvey. But as you mentioned, 60 people dead. Those are human lives.
Yes.
And we can't really quantify the economic cost of a human life. We know that the risks are increasing. As climate scientists, we're not arguing that if there hadn't been global warming, there would have been no hurricane at all.
Sure.
Really, what we're seeing is that the odds of more extreme heat, more extreme storm surge flooding during a landfalling storm, more extreme rainfall, again when a severe storm occurs. These odds are all increasing, and that. What that means is that we're more and more likely to experience a level of extremes that falls outside of what we've experienced historically, and that really, really tests our infrastructure. It tests our warning and response systems, and it raises the risks.
And we're doing plenty of testing right now. You are so right. Noah Diffenbaugh with Stanford, excellent perspective this morning. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you.
Now we follow the money. How much will catastrophic Hurricane Harvey eventually cost, and how much will you end up paying for what happened in Texas? Amir Jina is an assistant professor and environmental and development economist at the University of Chicago. And Andrew Sifford is a risk modeler with BMS Intermediaries. He's a meteorologist also in my weather tribe in the Twin Cities here. So, hey, welcome. Good morning, you guys.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Paul. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. Thanks for joining us. Andrew, I realize it's still early, but we're getting some early estimates about the total cost for Harvey. What are the catastrophic loss components that go into estimating the cost of a big weather disaster like Harvey?
Yeah, and Harvey definitely had a lot of components to it. So basically, you know, with these hurricane landfalls, most of the time it's focused in on wind. Especially on the insurance side of things. So that's primarily the main driver, especially when you get a large Category 4 hurricane like this that hasn't hit Texas in really decades. So that's kind of the very first component. Risk modeling companies or the type of analysis we take on is really looking at the wind. But as we kind of know now, you know, really the wind component of Harvey was pretty localized, and
yes,
you know, as you might have talked about previously, you know, there's a little bit of luck involved there. You know, the strongest winds actually came on shore over a state park and in a relatively, unpopulated part of the coastline. Now, there was definitely a lot of damage there, but the wind component is one of the top things we looked at. Then there's the storm surge component. Again, kind of luckily, the storm surge wasn't as high as predicted, and the storm surge in this case, there was some damage to storm surge, but it wasn't as feared. But really, Harvey brings out the inland flood component, which is a relatively new peril for the risk modeling companies.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really the driver right now of Harvey's losses in terms of, you know, economically and in the insured side of things. So right now we're looking, you know, it's definitely early, you know, the phones are ringing, claims are coming in,
mm-hmm.
Adjusters are on site for many of these insurance companies in Texas. And, you know, the loss range on the wind side is anywhere between $1.2 and $2.3 billion just on wind damage. And that's really just in the Rockport, Corpus Christi area. There
sure.
wasn't a lot of wind damage reported up towards the Houston area. And the storm surge in the same general area is probably under $1 billion. It's really the inland flood that is really adding up currently that could approach, and the private industry and the insurance industry side of things could be, you know, top $10 billion, actually.
So. Okay, so that's 10 or 15 billion there. But Amir, we know as many as 85% of people in Houston have no flood insurance, and many of them got flooded. How do we begin calculating those costs there to people's lives that may not have insurance?
So this is where it becomes very difficult to think about how we think about losses in these events. We need to calculate not just how much people need to pay, but who pays, how do they pay, and for how long are they going to be paying it. So in many of the cases with people who are uninsured, we can look to recent experience and see what happened in the case of Hurricane Katrina. And we saw that there was a lot of people migrating out of New Orleans. Maybe they ended up with better wages afterwards. There's some questions about where exactly people have gone to. But there's also evidence that they're withdrawing from their retirement savings. There's research that shows a lot of people end up on prolonged stints on unemployment insurance. And so the question is, where is the money that, first of all, calculating what people are paying, but also where is that money coming from? And how long is this going to remain a cost? The fact that so few people had flood insurance here probably implies that we need to follow exactly those payments very carefully. So to understand, I think as a point was raised earlier, to understand the inequality in the impact here, trying to see people who may not appear to have lost as much in monetary value, but who might have lost a lot in terms of what their overall income is. This is kind of a difficult situation to think about, but maybe there's people for whom that week's wages, and it's good to hear that Houston seems to be back open for business in a large part, but people who lost a week's wages might be in a situation where they're having to make difficult choices in their household investments. So between someone's buying a medicine 1 week and maybe they can't this week because they didn't make their income. So trying to look at those costs, which are often hidden, is a very difficult thing to do. But the recent experience of Katrina, although thankfully not that recent, is something that we can learn from to try and look at the overall economic costs here.
Yes, great perspective there. We're talking about the cost of extreme weather disasters like Hurricane Harvey. Let's take a call, you guys. John from Chaska, good morning. What are your thoughts here?
Well, good morning. I remember as a young graduate student reading some monographs that had to do with some of the paleo history of some truly monstrous storms. It had picked boulders up off the seafloor and thrown them far inland. I know that we're not at that point by any means yet. However, when we're looking here now at Irma being a record for current record keeping here is 185 mile an hour winds, what are we looking at that is coming our way here in upper level? What's the upper magnitude of storms that we're expecting by the end of the century? And how does one count costs for something like that? I'm not sure at all that economically we're going to be able to take this on other than just moving populations inland.
Yeah, John, great question. And Andrew, I want to kind of deflect that one to you because, you know, overall, the catastrophic loss modeling in your industry, has it changed over the last 10, 20, 30 years? What's the trajectory there lately and also going forward?
Yeah, great question. You know, basically, the industry of the insurance industry and then even economic models, we do look at history, right? So, you know, right now everybody's kind of honing in on the 1926 Miami hurricane, which is, you know, really the last great devastating hurricane that was a Category 4, I believe, when it made landfall in Miami in 1926. But, I mean, you know, a lot has changed in Miami since 1926, mostly the exposure and the type of buildings that are being built. So, you know, I think if we see one thing that's changed in the catastrophe modeling industry over, you know, the last decade or so is, one, it's new data. You know, all the climate research that's going on at various economic institutions and private and government institutions gets fed into these climate models and stochastic models. And from that, we develop these stochastic data set tracks of simulated storms to represent what the 1 in 1,000-year event might be or 1 in 100-year event might be in the greater Miami area. But with that, you know, the things that are changing is, you know, the building codes have gotten better, thankfully. So this gets incorporated in these catastrophe models as well. So as we go and model structures, buildings and other infrastructure, you know, we're hopefully better and more accurately at least assessing what the potential damage could be from storms like Irma or Harvey in the future.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing right now today. You know, we're going through the catastrophe risk model, seeing what simulations are present over South Florida for Irma and seeing what those scenarios represent, you know, and kind of using our best judgment meteorologically of what potential damage there could occur using these catastrophe risk models.
Sure. Great answer. Amir, is there any way for us to tell what the loss curve looks like going forward for the USA? I mean, how many Harveys and Irmas can we take before it's sort of a major economic shockwave?
Well, we've tried to do that in some recent research, and there's a lot of people working on it. It's a very difficult question because I know you're speaking to some climate scientists previously.
Sure.
The science on the intensity and frequency changes for storms is it's still a frontier area of research. So it's not something that we understand completely yet. But what we can do is take the best science, look at what the intensification is going to be like, and look at some other risks that, that places are exposed to, like sea level rise, take the best projections of those, and understand what's, try to understand what's going to happen as currently exposed coastal communities have increased exposure. Mm-hmm. What's very difficult to do is to understand what our policy responses are going to be to that. So how well prepared are people going to be? And I hope Harvey becomes, if there's a benefit that can come out of this, it's as a wake-up call to increase preparedness at local levels. But to try and understand how prepared people are going to be, whether people start to harden or to increase the quality of their infrastructure, invest in those adaptations, that's something that's very difficult to do, but we can think of scenarios, a best case where people are prepared and we have flood defenses and other things, and a worst case where we don't, and look at those. What we found in some recent research is that a place like Houston, when you're thinking of climate change impacts in general, it's facing, for want of a better phrase, a perfect storm of impacts. It's mm-hmm. There's a lot of nonlinear thresholds in different damages from climate change. And Houston is very close to a few of those. The sea levels are rising. Any increased precipitation from storms is going to be something which, again, amplifies that risk. It's also quite close to thresholds where heat is damaging people's health. And so it's facing these multiple stressors as we go forward. And then the important thing is that in places like this, they understand what their priorities are for adaptation investments. But also that as a nation, we start to think about how can we reduce this cost, this price tag for everyone through mitigating some of the emissions that are causing these risk amplifications.
Sure. Good. Listen, guys, we're coming up on the clock here. So if I can get you like a quick 10 or 15 seconds on these last questions. Andrew, I called Irma's eventual track and landfall the $100 billion question. Quick perspective on the difference between the eyewall running up Florida's pricey East Coast versus, say, a North Carolina landfall. Neither one is good, but is it a big difference in terms of dollar costs?
Yeah, and I think Matthew last year actually is a great example of what type of damage we could see, right? That's one of the scenarios we're actually looking at today. But, yeah, I mean, the Florida East Coast there is definitely has a lot more exposure, so that would be a little bit more damaging than if we were to get something in North Carolina. But we also know going into North Carolina, the inland flood aspects of more higher topography could also cause a lot of damage.
All right, great. Guy Amir, sorry, I ran out of the clock here, but Amir Gina with the University of Chicago and Andrew Sifford from BMS Intermediaries, thank you so much for your great perspective today.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Finally today, as I think about Harvey and Irma, a few thoughts. Many people I talk with deeply affected by these intense storms. We're seeing our fellow Americans in harm's way. We're also seeing amazing acts of bravery and support coming from neighbors and complete strangers. Compassion for human life always comes first. But at some point, these climate-enhanced disasters may take an even bigger toll. Climate science predicting this very scenario for decades. So what happens? How will this happen and how will we react? Who will pay for these losses? How will it impact our economy? Who will suffer from the lack of planning and from decades of not taking seriously what climate scientists told us was coming? Those questions are newsworthy and they'll still be there in the future. I'm Paul Huttner. Send hope for those in Irma's path. Thanks for listening. Now there's a wall between us.